This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio and streaming Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. And today we're going to start our show talking about dirt, specifically the first annual Dakota Innovation Research and Technology Workshop, which is about soil health, dirt, if you will. And joining me is a soil health specialist. Abby Wick has her doctorate and is with NDSU Extension. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
What was behind the decision to start this new event, the first annual?
The past 5 or 6 years, we've jointly held the Conservation Tillage Conference with University of Minnesota. Our doors were busting at the seams, and there were just so many people that would show up. We actually had a waiting list of about 20 people that could attend the event. So at 350 people, we thought we better split it up and have one in Minnesota that can focus on row crops and another one in North Dakota to focus on solid seeded crops.
So this is coming up December 9th through the 11th at the Delta by Marriott in Fargo. And you can find out more about it by going online to dirtworkshopnd.com. So how did you decide what to put in this workshop?
You know, I'm fortunate to work with a lot of different farmers and consultants and other educators and researchers. And so I talked to a bunch of them about what they wanted out of a meeting because I wanted this meeting to be about the farmer and to be their meeting. So that's what we did. I went around, I talked to a bunch of different farmers and consultants and got some ideas. And we came up with a pretty great format of sharing information, a lot of discussion and some demonstrations too.
So who should attend besides everybody?
Right. I mean, that would be the correct answer, everybody. But, I think farmers who are into soil health, if they're using it on their farms already and have been for decades, it's a great workshop for them. It's also great for farmers who are just reading about soil health and haven't done any of that type of work on their farms. And they maybe have some questions about how they're going to manage these fields that we have this fall that are so wet and the ruts and the, you know, how are they going to manage moisture and what are they going to do differently next year? And maybe soil health tools are something they can use on their farms.
And the format follows roughly the idea about this NDSU cafe talk kind of thing?
It does. It does. We started that a couple years ago where we just get in the same room with farmers and we have conversations and there's no agenda. You know, in this case, we're doing something very similar where we'll have groups of about 20 sitting down and talking over, you know, some guidance on a topic, but it should be very conversational and a good way for everybody to get a little information.
So how would you characterize soil health in the state of North Dakota?
That's a great question. I think we're on the forefront. When I've talked to any editors from national level farming magazines, they say that they come to us for cover crop information, which I think is really outstanding considering our short growing season. You know, in the western part of the state, our farmers have been doing no-till for a long time, and we're working on getting those practices over here in the eastern part of the state. And so I think we're strong. I think we can do better, right? I mean, everybody thinks they could, you know, looking for improvement is how to succeed and move forward. So we've got a great start. We've seen a lot of really good momentum, and we'll just keep going with it.
Well, I can remember a long time ago, decades ago, a generation ago, when no-till or minimum till was kind of controversial. I assume it isn't anymore.
You know, it's a challenge, you know, and I think so much before soil health came on board, it was talk about no-till or zero-till. And since then, we've really figured out how to stack the tools that we have available. So diversifying rotations, reducing tillage, whether that's one pass in the fall or waiting until the spring to do your tillage, incorporating cover crops, using other approaches that you can really stack tools and come out with a, you know, success story, something you can achieve on the farm by using more tools.
Well, let's talk about some of those tools and some of these innovations, too. What's new in soil health?
I think there's a lot of actually intercropping is kind of coming up in the northern part of the state.
And what do you mean by that? Mixing up the crops more?
Or? Yeah, I mean, growing two crops at one time to harvest both of them. So there's a lot of chickpea and I think it's flax work that's going on, or chickpea and canola. And Mike Osley out of Carrington Research Extension Center and another woman, Lana Schaub in Saskatchewan, has been doing a lot of this work. And I think farmers are really interested in the challenge of growing two crops at once, harvesting them at the same time, and then separating the seed.
And by growing these two crops at once, what does that do for soil health?
I think there's some interactions maybe that we don't fully understand between growing two crops at once. But certainly some of the biological interactions that may be there that we don't understand fully. But, adding diversity into the system, taking two crops that you can make more than 100% off of on the field. That's the goal, is to come out even ahead of where you would be with just a single crop.
Is part of this challenged further by the state of the ag economy, the prices for certain commodities, disagreements over trade, the falling dollar, all kinds of stuff that plays a role in the price of stuff?
Yeah, I think it does. And I think it comes out of this creativity that's just inherent in our farmers in this region. I mean, they want to be creative and they want to push the envelope. And a lot of times, I mean, we have such a diverse, you know, scope of crops that we grow here that I think it's kind of fun for them to get out of some of the more traditional crops and look at some of these other alternatives.
Well, what kind of research would you like to see into soil health? What hasn't been discovered? Or you mentioned the relationship these two crops might have, for example.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of great work that can go on. We do have – I have a research counterpart, Dr. Kaylee Gash at NDSU, and she's doing a lot of that work. She's a soil ecologist. I think that's kind of the next realm that, you know, that we don't understand completely. But it's also understanding that but keeping it at a really practical approach to understanding it. So if it's one thing to fully understand the system, it's another thing to have farmers adopt those practices because of those principles.
Now, everybody wants healthy soil because obviously it grows stuff better. Is the way we do things now hard on the soil?
I think, yeah, it can be. I mean, when you think of a healthy soil, you're thinking of a habitat where all these little microorganisms in the soil can thrive. And so they need a place to live and they need something to eat. And so in a soil that is typically not disturbed, some kind of reduced till system, that creates a home for these microbes. As soon as you start running any kind of tillage equipment through the soil, it breaks up those homes and the microbes have to kind of rebuild. They also need a diverse diet, so they don't want to eat just one thing all the time. And so the diversity comes in having a diverse crop rotation or adding cover crops in for that diversity. The tillage is hard. These wet soils this fall are extremely hard, and trying to manage those and manage for the ruts and everything is a challenge.
So if you were looking down the row in 10 years at North Dakota Farming Practices, is there any kind of prediction you'd make about the way things might be changing?
I think we're going to see more reduced tillage, especially in the Red River Valley. I work with a lot of farmers that are starting to get into these practices, some that have been using them for 40 years. But I think you're going to see more of that kind of approach of trying to minimize disturbance and trying to reduce erosion, trying to manage water in different ways besides tillage. And I think the farmers are very interested in that, and I think we'll see more of that coming in the future.
So NDSU Extension Service is there to provide information and research, science, if you will, into this particular enterprise. How do you think that's working? Are they listening?
I think so. I'm optimistic. I meet new farmers all the time that are showing up to events and wanting more information. We have a great county-based extension service or system. So we have these agents who are constantly learning and building up their skill sets and understanding soil health that are right there in those counties with those farmers. So we have a lot of really good resources, and I think that it's going to take a little time, but what kind of big change doesn't take time?
Well, communication's important. This is part of the job, I guess, talking on the radio to people across North Dakota. But also, you've got a podcast, the Soil Sense podcast. Tell us about that.
The North Dakota Corn Council basically said, hey, here are some funds to get some of these stories recorded. So I had a podcast host out of Idaho, Tim Hamrich, come to North Dakota, and he recorded these stories, and he had really enjoyed it. He talked with farmers, with consultants, with researchers, with extension, and he got this whole picture of what we're doing here in our state of working collaboratively and coming up with solutions that are realistic for any farmer, you know, to not just cater to the ones that want the really diverse systems and the really complex systems, but there's something everybody can do. And that's kind of what we looked at and recorded in this podcast.
Well, you were alluded to the various ways of farming that are out there, and there are different proponents for all of them, organic farming or regenerative agriculture or monoculture or industrial ag, however you want to describe it. There are different, belief systems.
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways of doing things and different comfort levels. And so one of the things that we really try, or at least that I want farmers to do or to come to this to table with, is to feel comfortable with the choices they make. And so if they're wanting to try something new, I want to provide the extra support that they need to make those practices work. I want the science-based information that's going to help them succeed in that approach. And so whether it's full no-till or it's strip till or it's vertical till or drop and tillage pass or incorporation of a single cover crop versus a multi-species mix. I just want everybody to feel good about what they're doing and comfortable with it, because in the end, that's what we need.
You know, when I was a kid, we moved to Moorhead, Minnesota. There were potatoes, onions, sugar beets, and some wheat. The crops have changed a bit.
Yeah, they have. And I think that's, you know, an interesting part about all this is we see these rotations shift based on pricing and equipment and what farmers want to grow. And you know, it's an interesting way to take some of these systems that maybe have gotten more simple over the years into maybe just two crops in rotation and add back some of that diversity that we've had historically in the area by using something like cover crops that's going to be a little bit different root structure, different type of material, building the soil and making some changes.
The upcoming first annual Dakota Innovation Research and Technology Workshop, December 9th through 11th at the Delta by Marriott in Fargo. Almost three full days of stuff going on. And you mentioned Tim Hammerich. He's one of the people who'll be presenting. Who else?
We also have Lee Breeze, Dr. Lee Breeze, I should say. He's gotten his doctorate now, and he's a consultant out of just south of Jamestown. And he's going to do our opening and closing keynote. And one of the things I wanted to do with this workshop was to really focus on the people we have here in our region. And Lee is outstanding. He's been recognized as International Certified Crop Advisor of the Year, National Certified Crop Advisor. He goes all over the place talking about basic concepts that can be applied regarding soil health. And so I'm excited for him to kind of kick this meeting off with being the first annual and to close it off, too, to keep people thinking and moving forward.
I didn't ask you a basic question, and that is, how do we ascertain soil health? Do people send you dirt?
You know, that's a good question, because there's a lot of tests out there, right, that would give us a soil health score or to say something's healthy. And I think of it more in the context of achieving on-farm goals using soil health building practices. So sometimes you can't measure those goals, but you can see them. For example, farmers that I work with down in the Southern Valley, they transitioned to no-till about 5 years ago. They incorporated cover crops. They still do a little bit of strip-till, or they've tried some of that to get some of their row crops going. But this year, in a very challenging harvest, when it was so wet and everybody was you know, sliding all over the place in the field during harvest, they hardly left a print in their field. And I think that's how, you know, how do you quantify that, you know, and say that's a healthy soil? But you know it is because they achieved a goal of getting the crop off the field, which is one of the most important things a farmer does. And they did it without really having much disruption in their field.
So do farmers tend to like to hear what their neighbors are talking about as opposed to people with NDSU Extension? I mean, is the purpose of having a workshop like this to get people together to share information?
Absolutely. That's a huge part of it. So we leave all kinds of time for farmers to talk and share information and get to know each other. And hopefully, you know, they're exchanging phone numbers and calling each other throughout the year. And I hope that some of those relationships start building. We've seen a lot of that in the past through workshops and through these cafe talks and through just introducing farmers that have common goals that may not live in the same area, but they have something in common. And so this meeting will be a great opportunity for farmers to get to know each other and to talk about some of these things, because everybody there is going to be interested in soil health in some way.
And the state does have a very diverse soil health and agriculture, ranch, farming. It's got a mix.
It's got a mix. And, you know, there's a lot of merit, too, in getting farmers from the western part of the state or from Saskatchewan or Manitoba talking with farmers in the eastern part of the state and vice. There's a lot that can be learned amongst farmers, regardless of their conditions. And if they're all of the same kind of mindset of wanting to improve their soils, then it's a great fit.
Abby Wick is a soil health specialist and the DIRT workshop organizer. That's the first annual Dakota Innovation Research and Technology Workshop. She's with the NDSU Extension Service, and that's coming up December 9th through the 11th. You can find out more at dirtworkshopnd.com and check out the Soil Sense podcast at ndsoilsense.com. Thanks for being with us today.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next, we'll commemorate a centennial of women's suffrage.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Woodhouse Restaurant of Bismarck, a locally owned family restaurant making the American classics from scratch since 1969 and offering homemade soup and pie specials daily.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Here's a piece of history I heard from my grandmother. The right to vote was won by women marching in solidarity. This year marks the centennial of the passage by Congress of the 19th Amendment. Recently, Emily Kulzer of the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County talked about women's suffrage with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. Here's an excerpt of their conversation.
Emily, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Today we want to talk about women's suffrage, the 100th anniversary, and how your organization is sort of marking this occasion. Can you talk about some of the events and things you have planned?
Yeah, so our next 2019 event is going to be on December 1st. We're teaming up with the League of Women Voters of the Red River Valley and Bonanzaville, and they're going to be hosting a celebration at Bonanzaville for the North Dakota ratification of the 19th Amendment. So it would be 100 years since North Dakota ratified on December 1st, and they have a dinner planned with a live band. And so that's going to be our next event. But for 2020, having the actual centenary of the 19th Amendment being nationally passed, we want to have programs on modern suffrage issues and voter registration on how to vote, because it's an election year next year, too. So we really want to focus on not just the historical aspects of the anniversary, but the continued struggle that many people have with suffrage today.
Take us back 100 years, and how long had it been where women were demanding the right to vote in this country before it finally came about?
Well, really, women had been demanding the vote before the country even started. But it wasn't until the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848 that was really the start of what we think of as the suffrage movement today. Women had been meeting before then to talk about women's rights, but it wasn't until later that suffragists looked back and saw that that was really the start of the movement.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you know, how hard was it? I mean, police, I'm sure, intervened in some of the protests. Talk about some of that, please.
Yeah, so getting the men in Congress to listen to them was probably one of the biggest challenges. At the time, men believed that women's place was in the home. So if women were out being politically active, who was going to stay home and cook and clean and raise the children? So just trying to get the men's attention was one of their goals. And in those efforts, sometimes the police would get involved, especially with the more militant suffrage groups like the National Women's Party. They were headed by Alice Paul. They did a lot of things like aggressive agitation and did some clever publicity stunts. A lot of women were arrested in 1917 and 1918 because they were picketing the White House in a time of war, and many people thought that as an act of treason to picket or criticize a president in wartime. So they would be arrested and placed in prison, and then a lot of the women would go on hunger strikes and eventually be force-fed, which was a PR nightmare for a lot of lawmakers. So people were outraged when they learned what these women were going through in jail, and that helped get the attention of Washington.
Yeah, but and obviously this took a long time, so why did it take so long?
So it's a difficult question. I think most people think it took so long because of, like, the sexism involved, and that women had a hard time convincing men that they were equal. But by 1919, suffragists had really been pretty successful beating down that ideal that women weren't equal to men. And it was less of sexism, but more racism that was really the cause for the long delay. African-American women didn't really have the right to vote even after the 19th Amendment. And it was the Southern Democrats that were really afraid that if these African-American women won the vote, it would restart the Civil War. And they thought that racial solidarity between these groups of women would be advantageous to the Republican Party. And it wasn't until the Republican Party gained the majority in 1919 that the 19th Amendment was actually ratified.
Is it hard for someone like you and you know, realize that 100 years ago, not that many generations, of course, women couldn't vote in this country. Something now you probably take for granted.
I would say that being a historian, I don't take it for granted just because I've read so many of the struggles that women had been through. And it's not really hard for me to realize that it was only 100 years ago. People think that 100 years ago was a really long time ago. But in fact, my own grandmother was 7 years old when her mother gained the right to vote. So personally, I don't take my right to vote for granted. I vote in every election that I can. And I vote because there are still people in this country that don't have that right.
Well, can you talk a bit about why some states, ratified the 19th Amendment quicker than others?
Yeah, that goes back to that racism, question. If you look at a map that shows when each state ratified, you'll see a lot of states in the South didn't grant women any type of suffrage. There were a lot of states in the North that granted women presidential suffrage, but no other types of suffrage, so they weren't able to vote in municipal elections or school board elections, just presidential elections. And I also think that has to do with the role of women. So in Wyoming and other Western states, Wyoming was one of the first states to grant women full suffrage, and I think that was because it was a pioneer state, so women were really out in the fields right next to their husbands and their sons working the land. So not only were they out doing the physical labor, but they were also bearing and raising children. So I think that the men really took that step to kind of salute their hardworking women.
You know, what do you hope people get out of the events you're going to do over the next year, and what kind of understanding will they get?
I hope that people will no longer take their voting rights for granted. I hope that the events will inspire them to get involved in the political process and inspire them to become informed voters. I know a lot of people think that politics isn't important, but politics runs through every facet of your life, whether you think so or not. So I think having that power to vote and have a voice is really important.
Well, and you mentioned your voting. What's your message, especially to women who maybe don't vote or haven't voted in a while?
Mm-hmm. I would just ask them to think about their grandmothers and their great-grandmothers. This was a right at that one point they didn't have. At one point, they were thought of as less than male citizens. And then they were not allowed to participate in the activity that really defines democracy. And in the last election, I told my mom and sisters that they better be voting, because it wasn't even 100 years ago that we women didn't have a chance to use our voices.
All right. Emily, thanks for joining us
today. Thank you so much.
That was Emily Kulzer, Director of Museum Operations for the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, talking with Prairie Pulse host John Harris. The Prairie Pulse television show airs Fridays at 7:30 Central, 6:30 Mountain. This Friday's guest will be Pam Sagnus, Director of the Behavioral Health Division for the North Dakota Department of Human Services. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with members of the North Dakota Women's Network about training women to run for office. And we'll hear about a new political project called Purple for Democracy. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. This past summer, the U.S. Marshals High Plains Fugitive Task Force expanded to the Bismarck-Mandan area. It's made up of the Marshals Service, Bismarck and Mandan Police, and the Burley and Morton County Sheriff's Offices. Since that time, the task force has picked up 100 fugitives in that area. They were arrested on outstanding warrants for crimes ranging from drug distribution to robbery, sexual assaults, and firearms violations. The task force also seized meth, heroin, and a handgun. Dallas Carlson is the U.S. Marshal for North Dakota.
I was surprised at the numbers when I saw them. I knew that they were busy on a daily basis. I'd check in with them and see how things are going. But the numbers were great. And not only the numbers of arrests, but the information during those arrests was useful to other investigators as far as they're trying to locate folks they were working cases on and so forth.
Carlson says the High Plains Task Force now has offices in Fargo, Bismarck, and Grand Forks. He says it operates throughout the state. The president of the North Dakota Petroleum Marketers Association says he's happy Governor Burgum signed a waiver of hours of service for those who haul propane, gasoline, and diesel fuel. Mike Rood says the wet fall and late harvest is causing increased demand for propane, and that demand is regional. He says a number of states have issued their own waivers.
There's probably a seven-state area in the Midwest, and everybody's trying to get the corn and the beans off at the same time since it was such a wet fall for a majority of these areas. So basically what we were trying to do is just try to keep up with the propane demand.
Rood says a lot of crops are still in the fields across North Dakota awaiting harvest, and that could also lead to more demands for diesel.
There's only so many drivers and so many transports, and so you start running into different situations where you don't have the drivers and you don't have the transports, and then all of a sudden, you know, the gas isn't getting delivered in a timely fashion, and the auto gas isn't getting delivered in a timely fashion, and the diesel's not getting delivered in a timely fashion.
It's a 30-day waiver. And when the search committee for the new president at Bismarck State College had its first meeting, the chancellor of higher education asked the committee to be aware of and open to a diverse field of candidates. Right now, no president at the 11 campuses is a woman. The last was Dr. Tisa Mason at Valley City State University. BSC Search Committee co-chair Dr. Dan Langang.
Well, I think the challenge is there, and I think we will embrace that as well. A diverse candidate pool is going to be very important for us. And I would love to see, you know, a diverse candidate come in and make our finalists. Again, how that plays out in terms of the best person, that's going to be the critical piece to it. But I think, you know, having a diverse candidate pool will be critically important. And I agree. I think there is a need for a perspective that we as a state system does not have in place right now.
There are six finalists for the president at UND. One is a woman, Lori Steinberg-Nichols. Dickinson State University will also be in the hunt for a new president. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Women fought for the right to vote a century ago, but if you look at legislatures or Congress, the number of women in office doesn't appear representative. As part of an effort to increase the number of women in elected office, the North Dakota Women's Network is offering a one-day training on North Dakota's political system and advice on running a campaign. And joining us to talk about it today, Christy Wolf in our Bismarck studio. Thanks for joining us, Christy.
Thanks for having me.
And Karma Hansen is in Grand Forks. Hello, Karma.
Good afternoon.
And you're with Angela Urlacher in Grand Forks as well. Thank you for being with us, Angela.
And thank you.
Christy, let's start with you. What is the North Dakota Women's Network?
The North Dakota Women's Network is a statewide nonprofit with a mission to improve the lives of women. One of our biggest initiatives is to get more women involved in the political process. And in 2020, we're going to focus even more on women in rural and tribal areas of North Dakota and getting them involved. And that means something different for every woman. For some women, that means running for office. For other women, that means testifying in front of a committee at the legislature or writing a letter to the editor. And for some women, that means just getting involved in a campaign. So we want women involved in the political process at every level.
Who belongs to the North Dakota Women's Network?
We have women and men from across the entire state who are members of the organization. So you don't have to be of any political affiliation, or you don't have to be a woman to be part of the organization. So we have people from all walks of life.
And coming up this Saturday, Ready to Run, it's a one-day sort of workshop on preparing to run for office, and it's aimed at getting more women involved. It runs from 9 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon at Gamble Hall on the UND campus. Karma, what's the purpose beyond what I just described for Ready to Run?
Yes, so looking at the purpose of Ready to Run, it's really about making the political process and being involved, whether it's as a volunteer or, as Christy said, testifying in the legislature or actually running for office, probably a little less scary. A lot of times people don't jump into that arena because they maybe don't know how to get started or how to craft a message or what the process involves. And so this is really to try to break that down a little bit, give them some education on the whole process, which hopefully will in turn increase their confidence and maybe excite them a little bit and ignite a spark that might say, hey, I think I can do this and I would love to serve in some capacity.
When I look at that description, Ready to Run, there's a trademark by it. So I assume this is something of a larger effort than just North Dakota.
Yeah, it is a larger effort. There are several states that do Ready to Run programming.
And this is the idea being that obviously, eventually you want more people in office. But let's talk about the political climate out there. It's kind of a turnoff to people of any gender, isn't it, or political persuasion?
You know, it can be scary for anyone. I remember the first time that I got involved, it was scary. really, this is about giving women the tools to get involved in the process. And so we really want to kind of demystify the process.
Well, tell us about your getting involved. What was that experience like?
So getting involved for me actually involved testifying at the legislature. That was the first time that I got involved in the process. And I remember sitting in the room with everybody sitting around me and in suits, and they all sounded so smart. and I remember sitting in my seat just terrified. And the first time I got up to the podium, I just kept thinking to myself, do not throw up, do not throw up. But I testified, and I felt so empowered after I did testify. And I continue to testify in the legislature now and work on policy work across the state. The first time was really scary. But it's been a great experience, and it's been really empowering to be able to work on issues that are important to me and important to my family.
Well, Angela, the sessions include stuff like what women candidates need to know, laying the groundwork, recruiting and engaging volunteers, developing your message, budgeting and finance, engaging young women. Let's start with that first one. What do women candidates need to know that other candidates might not need to know?
Well, for me, when I first went to Ready to Run, it was an eye-opening experience in that the women in North Dakota really wrapped their arms around other women. And I didn't realize that there was so much support among the women who are politically active here. And it was actually a big reason why I decided to run for office. And as we were going through Ready to Run, a lot of issues came up for women, experiences of sexism, the feeling that you shouldn't be running for office if you have children was something we talked about a lot. What kinds of things women should wear, how they'll be judged by their voice or their inflections or any number of things was something that all of us in the room would be affected by. And it was really, really empowering to have a bipartisan group of women talk about these issues all together.
Christy, Angela touched on some important elements there, but this is the 100th anniversary of Congress passing the 19th Amendment, ratified a year later. Why is this still a problem?
There are a lot of reasons. Women tend to feel like they're not prepared to run for office, to where men tend to just run for office. There's also a lot of, stigma. There's a lot of reasons why women don't run for office, or why they think they can't run for office when truly they can, and they do have the knowledge and the passion to run for office. And that's one of the reasons for Ready to Run, is to let them, give them the tools to know that they do have, that their voice is important, and that they do need to be sitting in seats where policies are being made and decisions are being made, not only locally, but also at the statewide and the national level.
Karma, what about the issues that are important to women in general versus issues that might be important to men in general? Are there significant differences there?
I think there are some that are different. I think there are some that are probably very similar. That being said, I think you have your key agenda items that go before every legislature. It might include things like property taxes or health care or funding for education and that kind of thing. But maybe how it's approached might be a little bit differently between those genders. But that being said, I think somebody that is an effective legislator is somebody that isn't going to come in necessarily waving the feminist flag, but really developing the respect of her peers so that it doesn't have to be about the fact that I'm a woman in this position, but I'm just an effective leader that's in this position. And I think we need to have this conversation not just for our state legislature or state elected offices, but I think women's voices are important all across the spectrum. So whether it be a church council, a school board, a county commission, you know, a city council, I think having a nice blend of voices across the spectrum is important. But I have never been a proponent ever of you should vote for someone just because they are a woman or just because they are a minority. I've been a proponent of vote for the best candidate. But I think as part of, you know, the women gender, I think we can take it upon ourselves to try to help groom and mentor and support people who are looking to run for that kind of office.
Angela, is it easier or harder these days to engage young women in running for office?
I would think it's a lot easier. I come from a very small town in Wyoming, so we really didn't have much engagement at all. And when I look at some of the young women I know around Grand Forks, it's really remarkable. They're really taking matters at the helm and going for it, which is fabulous to see. And there seems to be much more emphasis on getting younger people into office. And I don't remember that at all when I was growing up. So, yeah, I think there's a lot more support systems and a lot more focus on being civically engaged.
Christy, who should attend the upcoming Ready to Run gathering at UND on Saturday, all day, 9 to 4?
Women from any walk of life, we want them to attend. Tickets can be found on Eventbrite, or you can also go to our website, and tickets are available until this Wednesday. And there's only about 20 tickets left for the event.
Is there a charge?
Yes. It is $28 for the day of training, and that includes lunch.
$28.
That's correct.
All right. And you can find out more at ndwomen.org. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How many people do you expect if you get the 20?
We would have 45 total in the session.
How about this other issue here, Karma, developing your message? That is important for a political candidate. You know, we've had bumper stickers and posters in the past. Now we've got memes on social media. How important it is to refine and really develop the way you're going to communicate your political message?
I think it's critically important because if you can find your voice, find what your key message is and stick to that, then you don't have other people coming in and trying to create what they think you're running on and what your platform is or what they believe it to be. So as Christy said, you know, this is intended for people who are looking to run for office. But that being said, my current role that I have, I am the state vice chairwoman for the North Dakota Republican Party. And I have no intention ever of really running for an office. That being said, I'm in a huge support role in lifting others up and helping others get elected. And part of what my skill is helping them with crafting that message or finding volunteers that can assist or, you know, raising money, that kind of thing. So while it's important that people looking to run for an office on any level consider coming to this event on Saturday, nobody runs an election and a campaign on their own. It takes a big, huge support team. And so I think a lot of the messaging that we'll be sharing on Saturday is really something that could be helpful for people who maybe they don't want to be the candidate with their name on a yard sign, but they want to be somebody that can support their ticket or the people from their district or, you know, from the state or whatever the case may be. And so it's a very, very robust agenda that we have. And I've been working with Christy and we've been, you know, talking about who is going to be presenting. And wow, there's going to be some great people there that have a lot of expertise. And the fact that they're willing to come and spend a Saturday to share that and impart that knowledge upon the attendees, I think is really impressive. So I hope people will really consider getting signed up.
Christy, one of the elements that you'll be talking about during this Saturday gathering is laying the groundwork for public life. That is a part of being, you know, in the legislature or in Congress that might be particularly difficult for anybody to deal with. And that is you're suddenly this public person and everybody can take a shot at you. It's free speech, after all.
Well, and that part of our program is actually a panel discussion. And in previous years when we've had this, that's been one of our most popular sessions. Really hearing from women across the spectrum, we like to make sure that that panel has women that serve in the legislature, that serve on a local level, women that have run and not won their race. And so women really get to have a perspective from all different angles of what it's like to be in that position, to run, to sit on a city or county commission. And so that's a really, really popular part of our event.
Christy Wolf is Executive Director of the North Dakota Women's Network. Thank you for being with us today, Christy.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
And Karma Hansen and Angela Urlacher are working on the Ready to Run event that comes up this Saturday from 9 to 4 at Gamble Hall on the UND campus. Thank you, Karma and Angela.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, more information online at ndwomen.org. Coming up next, Project Purple for Democracy.
Musicians love to shrug off our need for sleep.
We will never sleep, cause sleep is for the weak.
That rough, I never sleep, cause sleep is the cousin of death.
You don't need sleep. That was the thinking back in the 60s, and that's the thinking that I had.
Meet the man who went 11 days without sleep, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Recent studies show that trust in the U.S. government is at an historic low. According to Pew surveys from 2018 and this year, only 17% of Americans surveyed think the government in Washington can be trusted to do what is right. And 4 out of 10 people believe democracy in our country is not working well. Public Radio's The Takeaway looked into the trust issue with host Sarah Gonzalez talking with Bob Garfield, the co-host of WNYC's On the Media. Garfield is one of the people behind a new project called Purple for Democracy, which aims to establish what it calls a new standard of civic participation through education and awareness.
Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sarah.
So tell us a little bit about the demographics of the people who distrust the government and say democracy isn't working versus the people who say the opposite.
Yeah, the bad news is it cuts across all demographics. This is not isolated. The even worse news is that it is more pronounced among Gen Z and millennials, where when asked to consider whether authoritarianism or army rule is on the table for a form of government, 29% said, yeah, that's on the table.
So what's contributing to this?
You know, Trumpism and the current highly fraught politics, polarization is obviously corrosive. But there's also the fact that Americans, by and large, don't know much about how their government is built, how it's designed, what the framers had in mind, and how it works today. This is because, first of all, civics education in schools is all but gone. It's been squeezed out of the curriculum by STEM and standardized testing. And, you know, people, Americans, don't even know that there are 3 branches of government and what their roles are. So the fact that they don't know how it's supposed to work certainly doesn't help. Fragmentation of the media, who used to be kind of arbiters and in some ways even cheerleaders for, you know, the core values of American democracy, well, that has been hyper-fragmented into a zillion little bits. That is mediated by Facebook, which traps people in filter bubbles, just feeding them more and more and more of content that serves their own worldview and validates them, but doesn't give them actually the straight dope on anything.
And I imagine misinformation on social media is also probably contributing to this.
Misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, conspiracy theories, just outright lies, some from our leaders in Washington.
Fun.
It's all part of the package, but this is not about contemporaneous politics. It is about broad public distrust and disfavor with our very way of life. And, you know, we got to do something about that.
Well, there's always been some mistrust of government in the United States. So what's different about what the numbers we're seeing today?
Well, in the 60s, in the heart of the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War, when there were people on the streets protesting the government, the surveys still showed overwhelmingly, like in the 70% range, that the public believed they could trust the government to do what's right. Now, I think they were naive, but nonetheless, they had faith that at least the government's motives were good. And now those numbers are in the 20s. It has been a precipitous fall. And I think for the convergence of those reasons we discussed.
And there might be a positive sign here. According to a Pew survey from 2018, 84% of Americans believe that the democratic ideal of protection of rights and freedom is important. So is that statistic a positive thing, despite the overall feeling among Americans that democracy isn't working?
Yeah, and I hope it's true. We do know there are things that people think they're supposed to say and not say in surveys. So it's hard to evaluate. It's actually also hard to evaluate the stats that I gave you from at the beginning. Those numbers are alarming. Do they really represent exactly the zeitgeist? We don't know, but they're certainly a concern. And if we believe the trajectory, it suggests that people are willing to throw out the democracy baby with the political chaos bathwater, and we cannot let that happen.
Right, because people talk about loving their freedom, but maybe they don't know what is enabling that freedom.
Right. And, you know, we often talk about our military, you know, across the ocean defending our freedoms. But if you say, well, what freedoms exactly, then you sometimes draw a blank. And, you know, people are woefully unaware of what the Bill of Rights even means. You know, it's only, you know, about 400 words. It's way shorter than bye-bye American Pie. But nobody's ever read it.
And Bob, what steps do you think need to be made in order to start building trust in government and democracy?
Well, you know, there are about 100 different NGOs, 501c3 nonprofits, who have been working this territory literally for decades, and they have done remarkable work. They have great research, and they have great content, and certainly great motives. And among them, for 50 years, they failed. And they failed, I can prove it, because look at these data points, right? And I think, or we think at Purple, that it's because they are so under the radar. There's no visibility. They've gotten no traction. They're not part of the national conversation. So we think that step number one is to make people aware of our democracy, to begin to sort of re-cherish our freedoms, not to whitewash the sins and failures of American society, but to understand precisely why a democratic system is way better than most everything else out there, including army rule. I mean, you know, as journalists, we're not supposed to draw conclusions, but I'm pretty sure that this is a better society than North Korea, right? So awareness, a little bit of, I don't know, what we call mindful patriotism. And we want to encourage participation because ultimately we believe that the ultimate safeguard against the dissolution of democratic ideas is participation. That's what bolsters the democracy, not the Congress, but us.
Bob Garfield is the co-host of On the Media and one of the people behind a new project called Purple for Democracy, which aims to establish a new standard of civic participation through education and awareness. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Sarah, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Sarah Gonzalez, host of The Takeaway, talking with Bob Garfield about Purple for Democracy. More information about the project at purplefordemocracy.org. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone energy cooperative generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 4th. In 1871, the first settlers staked their claims at the point where the railroad would cross the Red River. railroads were crucial in the settlement of North Dakota. Fargo was named in honor of William Fargo, a director of the Northern Pacific Railroad. Early Fargo was a rough-and-tumble town with its fair share of saloons, bordellos, tents, and shanties. In 1876, the population was about 600. But Fargo grew quickly. Settlers were attracted by cheap, fertile farmland. As families moved in, Fargo lost some of its wild reputation. By 1876, the tents and shanties were replaced by solid wood buildings. Restaurants, shops, hotels, and other respectable businesses sprang up. The population grew to more than 8,000. But Fargo wasn't alone. Fargo had a twin on the Minnesota side of the river. Some settlers moved into Dakota Territory, but a fair number stayed in Minnesota. Moorhead was named for William G. Moorhead, a director of the Northern Pacific Railroad. Just as the railroad fostered the growth of Fargo, it did the same for Moorhead. The railroad turned a journey that used to take weeks or even months into a trip of a few days. Moorhead was officially incorporated in 1881. It gained a reputation as Sin City. North Dakota was dry, so alcohol was not readily available. Moorhead was another story. In a city that was comparable in size to Fargo, there were over 100 bars. North Dakotans could cross the bridge into Minnesota riding on wagons provided by the bars. Falling off the wagon took on a literal meaning. On this date in 1915, the merchants of Moorhead placed a full-page ad in the Fargo Forum. The ad urged North Dakotans to cooperate with us by shopping in Moorhead. The merchants were offering special sales and discounts to entice shoppers to cross the river. Newspaper readers were promised they would save on every dollar they spent. In doing so, they would help in building up a model retail town. There was a sense that what was good for Moorhead was good for Fargo. A thriving Moorhead would attract a larger population. Land prices would go up, and prices of goods would go down. Fargo would thrive as well. Even today, the region is commonly referred to as Fargo-Moorhead. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
40 years ago, Morning Edition made its debut on NPR, but the show was almost canceled before it even started.
It was very chatty. It was like bad, small-market television.
And boycotted by its reporters.
They told us that we really wouldn't be doing very much for it at all, that we'd be writing a news spot here or there. They lied.
The rocky beginning of a show that almost wasn't. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, Moorhead native Preston Truman Boyd has lots of Broadway performing credits, and he's joining the touring production of Les Miserables as Inspector Javert. Boyd joins us to talk about his next chapter in his impressive stage career on our show tomorrow. And regenerative agriculture aspires to improve soil. We'll talk with North Dakotan Gabe Brown about practices to make soil and the environment better. Join us for Main Street tomorrow, and in the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.